And welcome back. If you don't think that reading a single book can motivate you for a lifetime, then you'll have to read former astronaut Scott Kelly's book, Endurance. It may inspire you just as Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff inspired him. That motivated him to take education seriously, become a fighter pilot, test pilot, engineer, and astronaut who spent 520 days over four missions in space, three aboard the International Space Station, which he also commanded. Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, tells his story, which includes how he learned in space about the tragic shooting of his sister-in-law, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Scott Kelly is with me in studio to talk about some of his story. It's great to have an opportunity to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
None of this would have happened, would it, had you not read Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff?
Yeah, I think that is the case. I was this directionless kid. If I was in school today, I'd be the kid with ADD or ADHD, even though I'd never been diagnosed with that. It was impossible for me to pay attention. It wasn't until I was in college and I picked up The Right Stuff that I found inspiration to do something that I, you know, previously thought was impossible.
And then you had to set about an arduous path to accomplish what you wanted to accomplish. It wasn't easy, was it?
No, it wasn't easy at all, but at least I had a goal, and I figured I had a plan on how to get there, and it started with me teaching myself how to pay attention and study and become a good student. You know, it wasn't an easy path. It was, you know, I think endurance was required. But, you know, sticking with it and working really hard, I was able to achieve what I dreamed at as a 18-year-old kid.
I don't want to get ahead of the story here, but I'll ask you at this point in our discussion, how are you feeling? I know you're under very close observation. You and your twin brother, Mark, another fellow astronaut, are under close scrutiny, aren't you, by officials, NASA, I suppose?
You know, they did a lot of research on us, and we're still research subjects, but, you know, it's kind of on a yearly basis now. But I feel no different than before I launched, maybe a little bit older. But I don't have any, like, lingering, you know, symptoms that I can, you know, relate or that are related to me being in space. I do have, like, structural changes in my eyes. I'm sure there are some genetic changes that from radiation and such, but I feel fine.
You mentioned in the book that eyes were a problem at one time, and almost, I guess, your fear was that it would cost you a part in the program.
Well, for this particular mission, I was assigned to it and then quickly unassigned to it because they had some concerns about changes that had occurred on my previous flight, which was 159 days, and thought that, you know, flying in space for more than twice as long would cause maybe more than twice as many problems.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I was getting a little ahead of myself on this, but let's go back to the missions themselves. I think people would be most interested in the experience that the astronauts have in a weightless state. You write much about the exhausting process of working outside of the module, the spacewalks, as it were. Give us some sense of what you're going through during that sort of thing.
Well, you know, talking about the spacewalks, I think of those as type 2 kind of fun. They're fun when they're done. Mm-hmm. Type 1 kind of fun is the roller coaster. It's fun while you're doing it, but it's serious business working outside the space station doing a spacewalk. And I tried to, you know, let the reader maybe try to experience a little bit what it was like doing that. So, and I hope I did.
You did. I enjoyed the book thoroughly. I mean, I found it fascinating and learned an awful lot. One of the things that I was thinking in reading it, by the way, when it comes to this whole spacewalk and weightless thing is how easy it seems. I mean, you're outside the capsule and you're just kind of floating around. You use the word float all the time in the book. But you speak of how grueling it is being outside the capsule or whatever and doing the work.
Yeah, it's physically – it's definitely physically challenging, probably the most physically challenging thing I've ever done in my life. And, you know, and for different reasons. You know, some are because of how stiff the suit is. You know, it's pressurized and you're in a vacuum, so you're working against how the pressure of the suit is, restricts your movements. The joints don't really move exactly like our own joints. It's very fatiguing on your hands. And then there's the fact that you're out in space doing the spacewalk that requires 100% of your attention all the time. So it's a pretty extreme environment you're working in.
You have to have one eye on that tether at all times, I would think. That's a pretty important piece of equipment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You tell one story in the book about a fellow astronaut who almost got away from you.
Yeah, well, it was interesting on this flight. One of the cosmonauts told a story about how on my previous mission, I was actually up there, and one of their colleagues during a spacewalk became untethered and just happened to hit something as he was floating away, which propelled him back into the space station. He was able to grab on, luckily.
How much thought do you give to that when you're out there? You're busy, of course, but that is always something that could happen, I suppose.
Yeah, you don't want to float away. In the U.S. spacesuit, you have there's a jet backpack that you could potentially use in an emergency to fly yourself back if you became disconnected from the space station. I wouldn't want to try that. Be the first person to try that. And you also worry about all your tools and the equipment you have out there floating away as well, and that happens every now and then.
Let's talk about working with the Russians in particular, and of course there are other nationalities that you're working with. What is that like? I mean, there are language issues, I am sure, and there are different – I mean, there's equipment issues. You use the Soyuz to get back and forth. It's a much different device than what you'd been used to prior. How do you work all that out?
Well, it's an international space station, and so we have crew members from many countries around the world, a lot of the European nations, Japan, Canada as well, and Russia. And people are often curious, especially now when there's often – you know, conflict between our two nations, how we get along in space. And, you know, it's been my experience, and I think, you know, probably all of my colleagues would agree that any, you know, conflict that we may have on Earth does not, you know, translate into conflict in space. We are crewmates, we're friends, and we rely on each other literally for our lives, and that kind of transcends any earthly problems we may have.
I don't recall any part in the book in which you and the Russians, for instance, talked politics. I don't remember any of that. Did you ever?
You know, we may on occasion. There was when I was in space this last time was when the Russians went into Syria while we were already there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit, but it's almost like you're talking about two other countries, not your own countries. It's almost like, you know, me and the cosmonauts having a conversation about that is like we're talking about like China and Germany. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not something that would ever affect our own relationship because we have more important things to worry about. My cosmonaut colleague, Misha, would said a couple of times in space, he said, you know, if we want to fix our two countries' issues that we have with one another, we should just put our presidents in space together for a whole year.
Yeah, I think a lot of people at this particular time might be thinking along those same lines. Are you political? When you're looking at the situation today, do you form opinions? Do you talk about that sort of thing?
I have a lot of opinions that I and I follow this political atmosphere and discourse very closely.
Yeah. One of the other things I found interesting about your book, of the many things, you began almost every chapter with a sort of a dream sequence. And the dream seemed very, very vivid and weird like so many dreams are. Were they different because you were 250 miles above the Earth, do you think?
You know, when I came back from my previous flight, the psychiatrists and the psychologists that work with us and monitor us, they asked me if I had any dreams. And I said, yeah. And then they said, well, can you tell us about them? I said, no, because I didn't remember. So this time I made an effort because people are curious about, I think just people in general are curious about the things that they can relate to. You know, everyone dreams, we dream in space. Mm-hmm. So I made an effort to write them down. And what I found was in the beginning of the flight, I dreamed about Earth. The longer I was in space, they transitioned to mostly space dreams. Mm-hmm. crazy like most dreams are. And as I got closer to coming home, I was dreaming more about the earth again. And I wanted to include those in the book because it's something that fascinates people.
They were fascinating. It was a nice touch in the book. I'm going to offer the opportunity for listeners to get into this conversation if they'd like to. 382-8255 is the number if you'd like to talk to former astronaut Scott Kelly. Send us a tweet at STL on air or send us an email if you'd like to talk at stlpublicradio.org. I'd like to get to the Gabby Giffords part of the story because I can't think of any greater feeling of helplessness than being 250 miles above the earth and being worried about a loved one and not being able to get to them at time. Walk us through that and what you were going through at that time.
Yeah, that's the worst part about being in space for a long time. It's not I didn't worry as much about my own personal safety as I did for the safety of my kids and my loved ones. And being able to – having experienced that firsthand with Gabby getting shot, it made it even more real for me when I was going to spend a year in space. And, you know, on January 8th, 2011, I got a call from the control center in Houston. They said they were privatizing the space-to-ground channel to tell me something. It took about 5 minutes, and then the chief of the astronaut office came on the radio, and she said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to tell you. Your sister-in-law, Gabby, was shot in Tucson, Arizona. A bunch of people killed. They didn't know how many at the time. And, you know, I still had a few months ahead of me.
Yeah. And at one point, it was reported that she had died.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The press started reporting that she had been killed. Mm-hmm. Clearly she hadn't been.
Would there have been any way at all to get off of that station and go back?
You know, the program is, you know, it's so expensive. There's so much involved that there is no earthly emergency that is going to bring you home. Mm-hmm. You know, short of something just absolutely catastrophic happening to your country or your planet where they are no longer able to function and support you in space. And you know that going into this, that, you know, no matter what happens with your family, you're not coming home. And that's, like I said, is the hardest part about being in space for a really long time.
Well, there are a lot of people now who are talking about going to Mars. We have a young lady here who's one of 100 who might the middle of the next decade actually make that trip. There is no coming home for those people. But you're fully supportive of that mission, aren't you?
No, actually.
Really?
Not the Mars 1.
Ultimately going to Mars.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's a great goal.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it too much because the Mars 1 idea is an idea and I think it doesn't, you know, have the funding that is going to be required. I mean, we're talking, you know, $100 billion perhaps to do that. But I think someone's signing up for a one-way trip, especially a young person, a one-way trip where you would then spend the remainder of your life living in a module on the surface of Mars with, you know, no ability to go outside, mm-hmm. no ability for, you know, to change your situation for the rest of your life is something that having spent a lot of time in space is not something I would want to do. Mm-hmm. I'd go to Mars in a second, mm-hmm. but I need the return
flight. Round trip ticket.
Yeah,
right?
I need that plan before I would do it.
Is that ever going to be possible? Would you guess to go and return? It's a year long flight just to get there, isn't it?
It's 200 days to get there, a year mm-hmm. on the surface, 200 days to get back. You know, when I was on the space station this last mm-hmm. time, I was being interviewed, and a reporter asked me. They said, now that NASA knows for certain that during some time of the year there is liquid water on Mars, is that going to help us get there any quicker? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know, maybe. Mm-hmm. Now if we found money on Mars, then we'd get there really fast. That's what we need.
Yeah, and you definitely want to get back if you found a pot of gold up there, no question about that. I'm going to take a call from Barbara, who was joining us in the conversation. Barbara, thanks for being with us. You're on the air with Scott Kelly.
Thank you for taking my call.
Not hearing Barbara.
There was a movie some years back with Stacy Keach about an astronaut who was put into a psych unit because in the 10-second countdown to takeoff, he decided to climb out because he had not made peace with his God. And I often wondered, If somebody was untethered in outer space with no dimension, forward, backward, up or down, or any place else, and no hope of ever getting back to what was familiar, would that have been equivalent to being in hell?
Huh.
A psychological hell.
You know, I've been asked a lot of questions. I've never been asked that question. I think, you know, if you were, you know, untethered and with no way to get home, I don't know if it would be like hell, but it sure would be pretty bad.
Probably learn how to pray very quickly if you're in that kind of a
situation.
Yeah.
It's like being in the foxhole, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara, thank you for the call.
And thank you.
Do you have a favorite outer space movie? She mentioned Stacy Keach.
You know, I like a lot of them. You know, Apollo 13, I think, was very accurate. You know, the fact that they used real microgravity in an airplane to film the floating scenes was cool. The Martian, I think, you know, a lot of that is technically accurate. Certainly, you know, there's certain things in them that, you know, if someone that is really looking for things that aren't behaving, you know, the physical properties of it aren't behaving like it really would. You could find mistakes, but I think in these kind of movies, if you're not, you know, bending the laws of physics a little bit, the movie's not as exciting.
Yeah. I guess, you know, was it ever boring? I mean, you talk about excitement. The routine was so standard day after day.
Yeah, there's, you know, definitely routine, but I was never bored. There was always work to be done, whether it was science experiments. We did 400 experiments over the course of the year I was there, or, you know, repairing the hardware, maintaining the hardware.
Toilets.
Toilet breaks. You know, if we're going to Mars and the toilet breaks and you can't fix it, you're not going to survive, so... You know, all of that equipment is very important.
You know, another thing that comes through in the book so clearly is the kind of planning that was done and that has to be done in advance of any kind of a mission. I mean, a little thing about thinking about a toilet we take for granted, obviously, but it's critically important in a jaunt like that.
Yes, you know, the life support equipment, which includes the toilet, because you need it to survive in space. It's, yeah. You can't run outside and use the tree if your toilet breaks.
But then having provision for discarding the waste material itself, the trash that is accumulated up there, all has to be planned out well in advance. Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about Mars a moment ago. We've got Mike with us calling from planet Earth, I think he's trying to say here. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Mike. John. Yeah, no, Scott. I've been kicking this question around for many years now. About our virtual future that I think we're headed to within the next 20 to 30 years, it's really a question of the opportunity cost of trying to go to Mars and to bring what I call visceral dumb humans to Mars just to so we can do it versus the need to secure our virtual future here on Earth or wherever we can go virtually. But I just wonder what you think about that.
I'm not sure I understand your specific question.
You're not familiar with the total virtualization of everything that is posited by many futurists in the very near future. I mean, you can see the way technology, you know, going to the moon, we used kilobytes. Now every phone has gigabytes, and within 20 to 30 years, that will be essentially inhabiting a virtual universe, and that's the real challenge, is to comprehend that future versus, you know, looking for moon rocks on Mars.
Huh.
Or Mars rocks.
So are you suggesting, like, we could all live, like, in the movie The Matrix?
Well, I hate to use movies because they're always so dystopian and just, you know, give you a disturbing... I think I thought about this back in 1967, and I thought, well, the future will be good as long as there's diversity. Diversity of input, and that's the real challenge of comprehending this future. Because right now we operate on biological electronics, and the real electronics travel, you know, 186,000 miles a second. We can't compete with that directly. We have to have filters that will enable us to manage.
Mike, let's try to mull some of that over. Yeah, I think we're getting a little bit beyond this planet at this moment, but.
Yeah, so Mike, you know, the way our technology is expanding. I mean, if you look at Moore's Law, right, about how the computing power increases, you know, every few years, doubles, you know, pretty soon that goes asymptotic. And, you know, I'm excited about that. I think, you know, we certainly have to, you know, be careful. But, you know, if you look back 100 years, you know, how much our technology has changed in that time, you know, the next 100 years is going to be, you know, I don't think we even have any idea what this planet's going to be like 100 years from now.
Boy, a baby born today, it's really, you talk about trying to speculate on what lies ahead, what that baby born today is going to experience in the next 100 years.
Yeah.
What another aspect of your flight in your book, Scott, that struck me was how much you missed nature, the wind blowing, rain. Just talk about that for a moment. That was something that you're in this capsule up there in this environment. Tell us how you missed that.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go outside except in a little spaceship called the spacesuit. So you're always inside, essentially, and there's no weather. The atmosphere inside the space station is almost always exactly the same, and it's something you miss. And I think, you know, when we have people going to Mars someday, they're going to miss it even more. And I think it's something we need to consider. And, you know, we had an experiment on board where it was growing plants and flowers. I think that's going to be helpful for the folks that travel to Mars. And, you know, with addition, people, I think I missed the most, people on Earth that I cared about. After that, it was absolutely nature and weather.
You were able to communicate, though, frequently with the people you love on Earth. That's another thing that surprised me is how often you're able to just get on the phone and have a conversation.
Yeah, it was great. I think a lot of people are not, you know, think because we're in space, we can't communicate easily with people on Earth. But, you know, when we're making phone calls here, probably a lot of them go through satellites, depending on where you're calling. It was a great connection. You know, the one good thing about it is you could only call people. They couldn't call you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you know, who you're talking to is completely up to you, which is nice sometimes.
Did you give a lot of thought to some of those disasters in space, Columbia, Challenger, those instances?
Yeah, we would, you know, think about them. And I didn't know any of the Challenger astronauts or the Apollo 1 astronauts, but I knew all the guys on Columbia, including three of my classmates. My astronaut 1996 classmates were on that mission, and you know, every time there's an anniversary, we would recognize it and talk about it and think about them and their contribution, and you know, the ultimate contribution they made to our space program.
There was also a period you write about in the book, Endurance, in which you were looking at a potential close call from space debris.
Yeah, there's a lot of space junk out there and micrometeoroids, and the space station gets hit often. Now, fortunately, that doesn't get hit with big stuff. Usually we see the big stuff and we can move the space station out of the way. But in the course of its lifetime since 2000, there's been four occasions when we haven't been able to move it, in which case we prepare for impact. And it's a little eye-opening when you're doing that and considering what could happen.
How do you prepare for impact?
Well, on the U.S. side, we close most all the hatches, and then we get into the Russian Soyuz and potentially would be able to use it as a lifeboat. But, you know, I'm kind of skeptical of whether you could do that. In, you know, this case, the situation we had a piece of a Russian satellite coming at us in the opposite direction at 17,500 miles an hour, so 35,000 miles an hour closure.
So if that hits your environment there, what happens to you?
I would imagine that kind of a collision with those kind of speeds, we wouldn't even know it. Just the whole thing would be vaporized.
Instantly. Yeah, I think that's the word you use in the book. Time for one more call. Let's bring in Charles calling from Chesterfield. Charles, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Howdy, Scott. Today's your day. So referring back to your having to come back and worry about changes in body and stuff like that. I was hoping when astronaut Senator Glenn went up in his 70s, he'd mentioned that space would be a great place to grow into a great new form of evolution. And when the bacteria and sterility and the gravity of Earth became your enemy, you could move up to space and never have to, you wouldn't have to worry about your bone structure and your eyeballs and stuff like that. It's something to think about for today. Thanks, Scott.
All right, yeah, well, you know, absolutely. If you move to space and with the intention of never coming home, I'm sure our species would evolve into invertebrates that didn't need their skeletons anymore. But, you know, living in that environment, too, is challenging in other ways. So, you know, there might be some advantages if you think, you know, gravity kind of keeps me down. It, you know, causes pains in certain, you know, as we age, we lose bone mass anyway. You know, why not move to space? But I think there are other challenges, too.
You point out the importance of exercise when you're up there for all that time. It was that's another critical part of your mission, personal mission, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you don't exercise in space, when you come back, you're not going to be in good shape at all.
No. The another element of coming back was the crushing aspect of gravity. When you spent all that time aloft, you come back and open up the hatch door, and gravity really begins to take over, doesn't it?
Yeah, it gives you a beat down, clearly. I mean, it's at first, it's not much fun, but you know, over weeks and months, you start feeling back to normal again.
Takes that long.
Yeah.
Takes long. Do you maintain contact with any of your Russian or international fellow travelers?
Oh, absolutely, all of them. But, you know, don't get to see them too often, but I do keep in contact with them.
How do you spend your time now?
Well, right now I'm on the book tour, so out promoting the book. This will take me through probably December. I'll do some other public speaking, but you know, come January, I'll need to find some new challenges, I think.
Let's let folks know you have a discussion tonight at 7 o'clock at St. Louis University High School Performing Arts Center in Oakland. Scott Kelly, the book is Endurance. Thank you so much for being with us. And congratulations on all your accomplishments. They're very impressive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.